It's indeed my pleasure to introduce our speaker, who's known to everybody, I think, Mr. Dick Colson. Dick has had a long career in law, investment banking, and private banking in New York, London, and more recently here in Nassau. He now serves as a director of several financial concerns and also as a corporate financial consultant. I give you Dick Colson to speak on peak oil.
Okay.
Thank you. Just to start off, I got a few pages here that give a very good summary of peak oil. I don't have enough for everybody, about a dozen copies. That's something you can take with you and read at your leisure. Give you a very good brief summary of what peak oil is all about. It was prepared for the Association of Peak Oil meeting last October.
I'll let
him
email
you one. That was an association that meets every year. It was in Houston last year. Now, we all worry about the current price of oil being in the range of the $90. Today it was about $90. We worry about it going up past the $100 barrier. We think about it going down maybe to the 90s, maybe down to the 60s a few months ago. But it's really pointless to think about these short-term price movements. What we should think about is the fundamental equation over the next 5, 10, or 20 years, the equation between supply and demand, which may well increase prices much further. Now, fortunately, there are plenty of experts who do think about this. Petroleum geologists, economists, investment advisors, specialized journalists, and more, even executives of the major oil companies. Many of them have come to share a theory known as the peak oil theory. You still don't hear too much about it in the popular press because its implications can be pretty scary, not only for oil companies, but for the auto industry, and for just about any individual who likes to drive on the gas guzzling road motors cluster. To understand peak oil theory, you have to know a little bit about the history of petroleum, and more accurately, hydrocarbons, of which oil is the largest component, followed by natural gas. The standard view about the origin of petroleum is the so-called biogenic one. Hydrocarbons were created millions of years ago from organic materials such as animal and plant fossils, and thus are a finite resource with depletion rates starting from the very first moment each field is discovered and begins producing. Although new fields are often discovered and developed, the total world supply cannot increase from the level where it started. Now, it may surprise you that this view is not universally shared. A brilliant but eccentric scientist who died just a few years ago, Dr. Thomas Gold, put forth what he called the abiogenic theory, that petroleum is the result of purely geological forces continually creating hot gases that rise from deep in the earth and react with microbic substances near the surface to form our hydrocarbon deposits. Since these gases seem infinite, optimistic followers of Dr. Gold but believe that petroleum supplies are constantly being restored and will continue to grow. Now, I personally am not qualified to have an opinion about Dr. Gold, but I can report to you that his theory is certainly a minority view. Petroleum geologists in Russia apparently give it a lot of credence, but their brethren in the major Western oil companies have never embraced it, and little, if any, petroleum reserves have actually been discovered that can be attributed to Dr. Gold's hypothesis. The recorded history of petroleum shows that oil has been known to humanity for thousands of years in the primitive form of surface seepages that occasionally could be used for commercial purposes. But the oil industry as we know it, with hydrocarbons steadily and reliably extracted from underground by the drilling method, is a pretty new phenomenon that had its birth in the United States in 1859, when the first commercially successful well was drilled in Titusville, Pennsylvania. From extraction of only 2,000 barrels in the first year, production rapidly shot up to the millions, especially to satisfy the automobiles being built by Henry Ford beginning in the early 20th century. And in that century, the system of drilling rigs initiated in Pennsylvania shifted to the far richer fields in Texas, Louisiana, and Oklahoma. For many years, the U.S. was the dominant petroleum producer. Then discoveries in Persia began to flow before World War I, and the enormous reserves of Saudi Arabia began to contribute in the 1930s, later becoming the prize of the state-owned Saudi Aramco. It's hard for us to remember that until 1970, the United States was entirely self-sufficient in petroleum. All the demand was satisfied by domestic production. In that happy state, naturally, no one worried much about scarcity or reliance on foreign countries. Unlike today, when two-thirds of U.S. oil comes from abroad, including, of course, our friendly neighbors, Canada and Mexico. Except one man who did worry. In 1956, an obscure scientist named King Hubbard, working for Shell Oil in Texas, startled his colleagues in an energy conference by predicting by the early 1970s, U.S. oil production would reach a peak and would start declining. To the chagrin of his many critics, he was proved correct. From about 9.5 million barrels per day in 1970, production has steadily dropped off to about 8 million today. Hubbard's prediction became known as the Hubbard Peak and forms the basis of the peak oil theory, to which all present-day petroleum experts give varying degrees of respect. Hubbard and his followers used the well-known mathematical formula of the bell curve to predict oil prediction. You all know what a bell curve looks like. A line rising from zero, an accelerating steady curve until acceleration slows up as the peak is reached, followed by a downward curve following a similar pattern. The peak represents the maximum production. At that point, about half the reserves of the field have been used up and production starts to decline. Oil produced on the upward curve is always the easiest and least expensive to extract. While on the downward curve, extraction becomes more and more difficult, requiring deeper drilling, lateral drilling, water injection, and other methods to squeeze the last barrels from the constantly depleting deposits. Now, the peak oil theory is not an alarmist warning that the world is about to run out of oil. Because existing oil fields began to be exploited over many different periods, so their half-life on the downward slope of the bell curve can extend for many years, and new presently unknown fields are actually discovered. But peak oil does tell us that we certainly cannot count on oil supplies increasing in the future, or even continuing at the present rate. You may ask, what is the historical evidence that, in fact, oil reserves have been depleting and production flat or declining? There's plenty. Take first the example of U.S. production I gave earlier. And we have heard about Alaskan oil, once considered a cornucopia when discovered in 1968. But the huge Poudreau Bay field, twice as big as the famous East Texas field, has seen production decline from about 3 million barrels per day in its heyday in the 1980s to about 1 million barrels per day at present. North Sea oil, when discovered in British and Norwegian waters in the 1960s, was heralded as Europe's savior and making it independent of Persian Gulf supplies. But in fact, production has been declining every recent year and is projected by 2007 to fall this year to fall about 50% from its top years, 1999-2001. Mexico's offshore Cantarell field, as they call it, has been the world's second largest producer, with over 2 million barrels per day in 2001. But the state-owned oil company, Pemex, itself has announced production declines of up to 15% in 2006-07, with a similar rate in future. Now, the reserves of Saudi Arabia are a big question. They are the world's largest, mainly in the giant Ghawar field. But the actual figures released by Saudi Aramco are considered highly suspect by many experts, since they show the same level year after year, even after annual production of about 8 to 9 million barrels per day. About 300 million barrels of stated Mideast reserves are called political barrels by an independent analyst. In the words of IEA, the International Energy Agency, the case of Saudi Arabia is striking, with proven reserves remaining at an estimated 258 to 262 million barrels over the past 15 years. A variation of less than 2% in spite of production and its extraction of more than 100 million barrels. The point is that revisions in official Middle Eastern and North African reserves have little to do with actual new discoveries, but rather have been adjusted for the political objectives of meeting the national production quotas periodically set by OPEC. Where do we stand right now? Oil production is measured in different ways. Taking just crude oil, it's generally agreed that the past peak was actually reached in May 2005 at 74 million barrels per day. If all liquids are added to crude oil, peak was probably around 85 million barrels per day in July 2006. Now, these figures are the starting point, not just for eccentrics in this business, but for serious scholars and energy consultants who differ only on the dates they give for exactly when peak has been or will be reached. To name you just a few, Matthew Simmons has had a successful career as a Texas investment banker serving the oil industry. and now speaks frequently at major energy conferences. The latest in Bermuda just weeks ago. He produced some statistics to show that the peak was actually reached in 2006. And Kenneth DeFegas, a well-known retired Shell geologist, puts it out 2005. Salman Bakhtiari, former National Iranian Oil Company planner, says right now, this year. Dr. Sadat al-Husseini, retired executive VP of Saudi Aramco, predicts 2015. Chris Grabowski, editor of the London Petroleum Review, forecasts 2010. Wood Mackenzie, energy consultant, foresees a tight balance, as they put it, around 2020. Now, the prestigious firm Cambridge Energy Research Association generally disparages all talk of peak oil and its promoters as publicity-seeking scaremongers. But even they, Cambridge Energy, predicts nothing better than an undulating plateau between supply and demand until about 2035, followed by an uncertain future. Now, many of these consultants, plus oil companies, gathered to exchange views at the annual conference of ASPOL, the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, that's that. And I gave you, of which several hundred gathered in Houston last October. Now, as might be expected, there are dissenters. ExxonMobil and the OPEC countries, with the largest reserves and the most to lose from declining production, seem to deny any foreseeable peak. Although even they are hedging on that statement now. It's certainly hard to counter the factual points made at the 2007 ASPO conference by the totally independent editor of the London Petroleum Review. What he wrote was that OECD production peaked in 1997 and has now declined by 2.2 million barrels per day. North America, Mexico peaked in 1997. North Sea peaked in 2000 and has now declined by 1.6 million barrels per day. 35% of global production is from declining fields. If Saudi fields prove to be in decline, which, as I said, is very uncertain, then 50% of global production is from refineries. Of 120 largest fields, 50 are in decline. The situation is summarized by one commentator. I quote, after rising 2 to 3% every year for the past 30 years, oil production has remained virtually static for the last 3 years. In the next few months, maybe a year or two if you're lucky, world production will start its inevitable global decline. Supply is only half the crucial equation about peak oil. The other half is demand or consumption. Demand is the way you look at it, without control of consumption. At present, world oil consumption between 83 and 85 million barrels per day, which is met by current production plus drawing on some reserves. Now, virtually all experts forecast demand at 115 to 120 million barrels per day by the year 2020. Think of the spread they're talking about between about $85 million barrels per day, those were produced 115-120 in demand. This increase won't come mainly from the U.S. or Europe, where demand is maturing, but from the exploding population growth of China, India, and other developing economies. Consider just one statistic. China, with over three times the population of the U.S., at present has about 18 automotive vehicles per 1,000 people, compared to 641 in North America. The growth potential for automotive use in China with attendant fuel consumption is truly mind-boggling. I believe that many of us Westerners do not yet really appreciate how China, and to a lesser degree nations like India and Indonesia, will come to dominate the world's economy in future years, leaving the traditional OECD countries as decidedly junior players. You can read how the heads of a half dozen dry cargo shipping companies describe the bulk of their business as shipping iron ore from Brazil and Australia to China. Without that business, they would mothball over the vessels and close down. You can read how 14,000 new cars hit Chinese roads every day, and how government plans to move 400 million people to newly developed urban centers by the year 2030. Matters like these give only a hint how China will distort the present axis of the world economy with the inevitable effect on demand for oil. The combination of downward supply and upward demand is the obvious consequence of escalating prices. In a perfect economic world, eventually supplies would smoothly rise and demand would smoothly taper off until a stable price level reached. But we are faced with something different. An actual physical reduction of supply that will be there, combining with an unrelenting upward demand that is little affected by price. While some experts predict the period of radical and unsustainable upward price movements, resulting in sudden crises marked by actual fuel unavailability at any price and inevitable rationing. That would be a painful time for all of us. The energy experts I mentioned above are pessimistic that the world economy can survive the future supply and demand imbalance without a crash program of mitigation, radical changes in government policies, and personal lifestyles to reduce oil usage. They are skeptical of the optimist claims. Petroleum optimists, without adopting the eccentric abiogenic theory I mentioned earlier, have a couple of arguments. First, they believe that improved technology will allow existing known fields to be exploited for a much greater percentage of their capacity. But the average worldwide recovery rate for all fields is about 35% of stated reserves, a fact of life. The industry has no miracle technology that can offset the inescapable depletion rates of 2-4% annually. Second, the optimists claim that new discoveries of conventional oil reserves, new discoveries, will continually replace what's already been used up. This seems to be the cheerful view of such writers as the late Julian Simon in his oft-cited 1996 book, The Ultimate Resource. Although it's a fascinating book and valuable in many respects, I find his arguments on this point singularly unconvincing. I'll read to you one of his key statements, quote, "It costs less today to get oil from the ground in prime sources than it cost 50 years ago to get it from the ground in prime sources," unquote. The joker in this statement is the reference to prime sources, as if they continued unchanged. In fact, the prime sources of yesterday simply do not exist in today's petroleum world. Let's look at a few comparisons of how oil was found in the past compared to today and tomorrow. The Texas petroleum industry is said to have been launched with the famous Spindletop well on the Salt Dome near Beaumont. Spudded in October 1990, it reached a depth of about 1,100 feet and blew out in a spectacular gusher only 4 months later. The many pictures of it, oil rushing out, blowing the drill pipe in the air, people running away, terrified from this gusher of oil. It blew out in a spectacular gusher only 4 months later, after being flooded in January 10th, 1901. Capped after 9 days, its early flow was 100,000 barrels per day and led to the discovery of many nearby wells and a major revival of their area beginning in 1925. Then the huge East Texas field was initiated when, on September 5, 1930, the Bradford number 3 well reached 3,592 feet and was soon flowing oil and gas. Financed with a few thousand dollars raised by the colorful wildcatter Dad Joyner, we've written about many times. By midsummer 1931, 900,000 barrels per day were flowing from 1,200 wells drilled in the surrounding Woodbine sand deposits, and East Texas became the largest producing field in the United States. Elsewhere in Iran, the Anglo-Persian Oil Company commenced large-scale drilling in 1908 and was producing by 1913. Standard Oil Company discovered oil in the Saudi Arabian desert in 1936 and enjoyed its first success in 1938, leading, of course, to the still unmatched Ghawar field in the 1950s, drawing oil from depths of 6,000 or 7,000 feet, and the spread of petroleum discoveries to the other Arab nations bordering the Persian Gulf. Note that all these resources were discovered exploited on dry land, without the immense difficulties of offshore drilling. For contrast, let's look at the hard facts of the really amazing new discoveries that are now cited to prove we will never run out of oil at affordable prices. Closest to home is the so-called Jack II discovery in the Gulf of Mexico, announced by Chevron in September 2006, said to contain between 3 and 15 billion barrels of oil. This is found 28,000 feet down in complex geology and under 7,500 feet of seawater. The technical difficulties and expense of extraction and transportation to a refinery will be formidable. Today, only a test well has been driven yielding about $6,000 per day. Even in the most optimistic and unlikely case, a 15 billion barrels being extracted, that's only 6 months remaining. We have also heard about the Kashagan field in the Caspian Sea, said to be the biggest find in three decades. It's in the territory of Kazakhstan, a notoriously difficult government, which is now demanding $7 billion compensation from Exxon and its other corporate partners for delays and overruns. It's due to start pumping in 2010, rather than the original 2005, at a cost of merely $157 billion. And just last December, Brazil announced an estimated 8 billion barrel deposit from the Tupi field, 180 miles off the coast, which would take Brazil's number 12 position in world oil reserves, ahead of Canada and Mexico. Again, the discovery is on the far edge of feasibility, under 7,000 feet of ocean and 16,000 feet of solids, including a 1.2 mile thick layer of rock hard salt. Drilling the first well cost $240 million, and at least $5 million will be needed for the next stage of development. Petrobras, the Brazilian leader of the consortium, has already shown great ingenuity in offshore drilling, but this will be their biggest challenge yet. In giving these three examples, I give full credit to the technical ability and expertise of the miners. But of course, they would prefer to be drilling on land and at lesser depths. The point is, these ingenious companies, with all their highly refined searching techniques, simply cannot find such locations. They are forced to go offshore and go deep, tougher and more expensive, despite what Julian Simons has told us. Way back in 2002, Harry Longwell, the Exxon executive in charge of exploration and production, the guy directly in the business, wrote, I quote, "It's getting harder and harder to find oil and gas." This is quoted in The Last Oil Shock, a book published in 2007. Unfortunately, I've not yet found. Anybody else seen it? The optimists also put their faith in what's called unconventional oil, or heavy oil, derived primarily from the Athabasca tar sands of northern Alberta, Canada. The underlying reserves are theoretically larger than those of Saudi Arabia, but the ambient oil cannot be drilled out in the normal way. The technical complexity of extracting usable refinery oil from tar sands are so great that not more than 1.2 million barrels per day are being extracted at present, possibly increasing to 4 million barrels per day by 2015. Still, only a small fraction of total world oil needs. As prices rise, of course, more and more large and small firms are sinking funds into Alberta, including Shell. Almost every day I found an email with an invitation to invest in penny stock shares of companies touting the tar sands. Perhaps fortunes will be made, but perhaps not. Similar reserves are found in the Orinoco Basin in Venezuela, but realistic production potential is hard to determine. because the political policy of Venezuelan government restricts exploration. Finally, the highly wanted oil shale in Utah, the western states of the USA, continues to be disappointing because the high cost of extraction has defeated all efforts to get a satisfactory return on investment for anything but experimental projects. Now, all this bad news about oil and the virtual certainty of people should not blind us to many other sorts of energy aside from petroleum. Our problem is that oil has become so deeply ingrained into the world economy. Not only is 80 to 90% of transportation fueled by oil products, but 95% of all goods in our shops include oil in their production. And 99% of our food involves oil or gas or fertilizers, agrochemicals, cultivation, and transport. This means the most vigorous and immediate steps must be taken to wean us from our present overdependence on oil. Each country must take the measures best suited to its own capabilities. Here, I will limit myself to the Bahamas, for we do not have the landmass to grow millions of acres of corn for ethanol, which in itself is a highly dubious substitute for gasoline. Last year's report by the Haley and Aldrich consulting firm does provide a range of alternative energy sources to reduce the roughly 467 million that is spent annually on power generation using fossil fuels. A figure which is constantly increasing with growing demand. Solar energy in the form of thermoelectric cells is recommended by the study as the principal alternative energy service. Each cell or residence being available what they estimate at $3,000. Wind power is somewhat downplayed by the report, as Haley Aldrich had a low assessment of prevailing wind velocities across our territory. However, I can tell you the locally based marine firm that operates wind farms in Denmark, England, and Bermuda is confident about the local potential and made a specific proposal to the previous government for a series of offshore wind turbines that would be linked to the BEC grid. The proposal was ignored, but I hope it will be renewed to the present government. Another recommended power source is OTEC, OTEC, Ocean Thermal Energy Conversion. For a 20 degree centigrade difference between cool deep waters and shallow warm waters can be used to generate electricity. Although the technology is still in its infancy, government could commission a pilot study as our geography brings the necessary water depths and temperature contrast very close to the shores of many of our islands. Finally, the study recommends the already well-known technique of burning biomass. If government ever finally authorizes the Ocean Key LNG project, and a potential on the Freeport, surely a portion of the natural gas can be siphoned off for local use rather than being sent to Florida getting a reasonable saving over the fuel oil presently used in our generating plant. That's the supply side. We should also think about the demand side, seeking an outright reduction in the amount of energy of any source that we, as individuals, consume. Automotive fuel represents the greatest potential reduction. While we can have little influence on the types of electrics or hybrid vehicles manufactured by the automakers, we can certainly restrict automotive imports to vehicles of limited size and energy capacity, engine capacity. This will doubtless cause political uproar and some cries of anguish from our car dealers. But it's a step that had to be taken in Bermuda, and it's a much bigger problem we do. There, it's one car per family, 168 inches in length, 2-liter engine capacity, and not older than 6 months when you import it. We don't have quite the problems for Bermuda, but we're getting close to that, not just in fuel consumption, but in congestion. In Singapore, it's somewhat the same. They keep a tight rein on automotive growth with a quota system. Also, a national public bus system with fewer larger vehicles, and above all, a school bus system to sharply reduce use of private cars. And to reduce our draw on the public power grid, we could switch from incandescent light bulbs to more efficient fluorescent ones, a step that will become mandatory throughout Australia in 2010. We must not delude ourselves that these steps will eliminate our demand for oil. It's super basic. But they will certainly have the effect of reducing demand so that we may reach some level of equilibrium between demand and supply and eventually a stable price settlement. Without such measures, we might see a future where private driving is virtually eliminated, leaving the roads to essential government or hospital vehicles, bicycles, and buses. And we enjoy electric power for just a few hours a day. Life could carry on, but not in the way we know it. Finally, I must say to the members of this distinguished institute, some of whom have a suspicion of all efforts of government to aid the economy, I must express my own conviction that alternative energy electives and reduction of demand cannot be left entirely to the private sector. Moral suasion will not get us very far. We must accept that where radical changes are called for, the state must step in and enforce them, just as the U.S. Congress has recently set higher fuel efficiency standards over the unyielding objections of the auto industry. Our task will be not to fight government, but to help them make the most sensible decisions. Thank you.
Questions, Dick? Jump to some questions from the audience.
Any questions, or comments, or whatever?
Come clean with us. Are you a pessimist or an optimist on the supply chain? You pretty much stayed down the middle of the road on the supply side.
What?
Are you pessimistic or are you optimistic regarding the future outlook of supply?
Am I happy with...
I
mean...
You mentioned shale oil.
Yeah. I mentioned shale oil during
Shale oil.
Yeah.
The United States could be the Saudi Arabia of the world if it could master the technology.
Yeah.
The price is certainly sufficient. 40 years ago, it was commercially feasible to produce hydrocarbons from shale at $35 a barrel.
Yeah.
Oil in those days was, what, 5 to 7? Today, it went out at, that was under 90. It was, actually, 89, 88. What I'm trying to get at is the fact that the price is almost... doubled or up almost 150 to 200%. And yet, there is no progress in developing that abundant resource in the United States. You say there's been attempts, endeavors.
Yeah,
what is holding that back? What is holding an Exxon back that last year became a deficit producer for the first time?
Well,
what is holding it back?
The crucial fact that no new refineries have been built. Aside from, in addition to extraction, you've got to have a way to refine them. And people like Matthew Simmons point out that much of our pipeline system, our refinery system, is old and rusting, and no new refineries have been built. Now,
I'm not sure
whether this is because of the environmental movement or not in my backyard syndrome, but the fact is that without any growth of refineries.
But Simmons' argument was based upon the fact that there are tremendous potential resources of hydrocarbons existing in the United States, in Canada, the tar sands, which you talked about. In terms of shale, as I said, it would be two to three times the size of Saudi Arabia. So there's abundant potential. And the price, as I said, had to be $35 approximately 40 years ago. Today the price is less than $90. I mean, where is the investment going in to make this a productive resource for the United States? Is it trapped by the government? Is the government holding it back? Is it the environmentalists? I mean, is this ever brought up in your travels to the
apparently, I mean, a lot of companies are now investing. I don't think much is going into shale, Western shale thing, because it's still too difficult. But more and more companies, as the oil price rises, are seeing potential in the tar sands of Alberta. And the Suncor, the Canadian company, Shell, another Canadian company, Encana, and all these small entrepreneurial wildcatting companies are all rushing in to Northern Canada. And the problem there is it's hard to get labor to do the job, and the environmental problems are big too.
Yeah, Nick, you know where I think we talked about this huge, tremendous reserves of coal in the United States. Well, that's like 300 years of coal reserves.
Yeah.
Oh. I mean, is there some sort of movement?
Yeah.
Because technology now.
Coal is another alternative. I mean,
absolutely.
I couldn't go into all the alternatives. But our coal has got its own economies and got its own consideration, but certainly is good for some. Natural gas. Although natural gas is suffering some of the same physical problems of extraction that oil is. So the natural gas, if you can get it, is a good cheap product, but it's hard to get enough of it to make a huge difference.
Do you see any benefits to rising oil prices?
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any benefits to rising oil prices? I tend to feel that as a result of rising oil prices, some other alternative is going to be found much sooner.
Well, I mean, rising oil prices and Matthew Simmons talks a lot about it. He said that the increasing revenues made by companies or government companies should be invested more vigorously in facilities and equipment and facilities, which he points out in the United States and other parts of the world are wearing out. He uses the word rusty many times. And he said, if the increasing funds from the sale of oil at a high price were invested properly in new productive facilities, improving productive facilities, that would make a big difference.
As an automotive supplier, I would have no problem with government restricting the size of vehicles, by the way. But isn't there some, all the subsidies that go into oil and production and all that, isn't there some merit to remove those, let government say, look, you're on your own, you develop it, let the price rise, and then the market develops from there?
Well, I mean, yeah, I'm sure, let the price rise and then let the higher prices go into all these new projects, right? But, and I mean, government subsidies should be part of it, but it should be, other than government subsidies, it should be. I don't know the economics of how a company like ExxonMobil works, but guy like Matthew Simmons says that a lot of these companies are making a lot more money, but they are not yet doing the good thing of reinvesting that money, the increasing revenue, into better pipelines, better production facilities, and at last, beginning in the United States, beginning to construct new refineries. And that's what he says should happen.
There was an issue of oil and gas journal some years back, which off and off, almost off the wall, forecast was made the need for 158 brand new refineries in the United States within the next couple of decades. But that was pretty well pissed off eventually. The number was huge. But the point you brought up here is investment in refineries is really a no-no. Today, you have to pay people to take a refinery off your hands. Environmental cleanup costs are such that nobody with deep pockets wants to own a refinery. Look at Neom, the huge SO facility you had in the north, biggest in the United States, and they were very quick to dump the whole thing. They don't own a thing over there anymore. And I think that's true throughout the petroleum industry, is to get your capital investment back out and bring in somebody with less deep pockets, frankly, to do the dirty work, and simply buy from them. That's a long-term problem. I don't see an end to it.
Yeah.
And you did mix the two a bit together
in talking about
the shale. And speaking of the Canadian shale,
stand up and stretch a little bit anyway.
Okay. I
did considerable work for Sun back in the years when Suncor was probably the only one in the world actively moving Athabascan oil sands into production.
Yeah.
And this was a period when certainly crude oil was marketed under $20 a barrel. And yet the Canadian government and Suncor went ahead moving. They move 120,000 tons of dirt a day into this processing, and they were not making any great amount of money then. But as this gentleman pointed out, certainly today, with all the background they've had now for many, many years, and Suncor has been at this for, I think, at least 25 years, probably even longer, and with oil way up from what they operated that for many years. I can't see how they could avoid finding it profitable now.
You know, it was you who first mentioned that the OTEC methodology to a Rotary Club. Mm-hmm. And as you said, it's a very new, not much has been done to develop it, but Again, those things have potential. Do you have any views about what more can be done?
Well, as I said on that occasion, I think we in the Bahamas fail to realize what a very unique position we have in terms of the symmetry and juxtaposition of hot and cold water. We are probably the best OTEC candidate in the world. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're way behind many others who are moving ahead in the field. But yeah, I am happy.
You just wanted one of the things that you make a real effort to get more knowledge about it. There has to be a pilot plan.
Within the last month, I was in Bora Bora, where they have built half a OTEC plant, in effect. The new Intercontinental Hotel in Bora Bora uses a cold water pipe. They put down 1,000 meters and are drawing cold water up and air conditioning the entire facility. Some early news reports said air conditioning the whole island is not true. It's only Intercontinental and the spa associated with it. But we have an ability to do that anytime we want.
Yeah.
We've got deep water we can bring up. And they discharge it back again at a depth below that which coral will grow, which is about 300 feet, so they don't disturb the coral growth with it.
Peter, I think you had a question.
Yeah, Dick, I got a couple of points. Most of your paper, you mentioned Saudi, obviously, is a major producer. United States, Canada, Gulf of Mexico, and nothing was said about Africa. Nigeria, for example, which has got massive reserves, produces about 2 million barrels a day. Equatorial Guinea, Cabinda in Angola. I just wonder, when you see a statement like this Aspro paper, how certain they can be about it. The peak, you know, 2015 is what they put in this paper. Because exploration must be going on all the time. The second point, do the first point first.
I mean, there is exploration going on all the time. And Africa, certainly, there's exploration going on, in particularly offshore Africa, the west coast of Africa. And exploration going on other places, but I can only hit what are called the big discoveries. And the three I mentioned theoretically, the biggest discoveries of the planet. Now, there are smaller discoveries that are happening offshore other places, all of which face the same kind of problem of, you know, the money you've got to spend offshore drilling. Now, maybe some of them will be successful quite early, but some won't.
And you have to look at the longevity.
And another place I didn't mention, because we don't get much information about it, is Russia. I mean, the Russian oil production today is quite large, very large, but they don't release any figures for analysts to say this is what the reserves are, this is how long it will continue. So it's a big question mark.
Yeah, I think doesn't one also have to look
and
at
the China, but the same way.
You have to look at the longevity, because Shell went into Nigeria as long as it goes 90. In fact, the other thing is that the byproduct, of course, is the gas, which is just flared at the moment.
Yeah.
And that is one of the sources for LNG, isn't it? So there's a connection there. The other point I wanted to make, Nick, was is it not right that in Brazil they are already using ethanol big time as a replacement for gas for vehicles? I thought it was. I thought that was. Didn't Bush go down there the other day and made a big thing about this, and now corn production has gone up in the United States and the price has gone up. Yeah. Hasn't that happened?
Brazil is almost all sugar-based.
Well, sugar-based?
Yes.
Anyway,
because
this paper is very dismissive. One sentence on paragraph 4 saying it's no good.
The point is that in no country, United States or elsewhere, is oil production following the oil price, not that. I mean, there are people in the oil industry saying, gee, price is one thing,
But the price keeps going up, and our production increased, cannot match the price increase because the oil, we just can't get out of it. The oil is not there to get out of it.
Right, well, the investment goes into corn or sugar or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting that ASPO dismissed this in one sentence, the alternative fuels. I just find that interesting from the oil industry. And one wonders whether this is realistic or is it forcing the price up? I mean, what do these predictions do? Is there a linkage?
What?
Is there linkage there, maybe?
Yeah.
I just wonder.
Right. Yeah.
Being skeptical of government.
Well, you look at the price of corn, and it's at a record highs. It's skyrocketing.
Is it not possible, I mean, from a skeptical perspective, that this is an invention peak oil perpetuated to bring about a price increase, and that there is no real aim at servicing the entire demand, because that, of course, would then bring the price back down. And the diamond industry does the same thing. Rolex does the same thing.
And I think, of course, I mean, because of inflation, present dollars are hard to compare with past dollars. But despite inflationary effect, I mean, the price that you get for gas now, and the price of these enormous costs of getting it are even inflation adjusted are much, much higher than they used to be. I mean, when was oil $35 a barrel? 2 years ago? And inflation hasn't increased from $35 to $100 or $20. So real prices and costs have gone up.
Dick, there's one question over here. And is that this? No? Anybody else have a question or comment? We can.
Oh,
sorry.
Yeah, I have a comment. My name is Doug Kay, and I'm from Virginia and San Diego. And Dr. David Allen is my brother-in-law, so we come here often. And I recently invested in some what looked to be very, very promising oil fields in the West, in the Rockies. And though I have a concern about peak oil and the demand, especially China and India rising, I've got to tell you, there's still oil out there. I mean, we're looking at about a billion barrel field. You know what, 2002 or 2004 in Utah, the Covenant Field, a billion barrel field. When, you know, people said, there's oil there. And Anschutz up in his ranch up in Wyoming, get gas.
I just want to say that there's a tremendous amount of material that you can find through the internet about peak oil. And every 6 months, there seems to be more material. And you can search and search and search, and suddenly you find something new that you know about. And what's interesting is that you get all sorts of statistics. They vary slightly, but they're all show the same trend about why we will have peak oil. You never find anybody coming out with a real study, except possibly Saudi Aramco, saying there will never be peak oil. So the peak oil theory is no longer a minority theory. It is gradually, even executives of major oil companies saying, gee, you know, BP, companies like that, we've got a real problem on our hands. So it's not as if I'm picking and choosing. You just don't find any big study to be made. This ASPO, the Association for the Study of Pig Oil, is a tremendous gathering place of information and release of that information. And you can cross-examine that, you can study different sources, but it all heads in the same direction. The only difference being, well, when exactly the peak oil, that's where people differ. But there's one report I have, it lists all the people from actual oil company, the French oil company, who say, yes, the peak oil was reality. We just, the production is just...
And I don't doubt the possibility or even the probability that oil production will peak. It's just that I'm fortunate. I'm investing in something where we're about to drill. And, you know, personally, I love the idea of peak oil because my reserves are going to be worth a fortune. But I think there is something, you know, the lack of refinery capacity. Obviously, I'm an American, so in the United States. And quite frankly, I don't see a heck of a lot of major oil companies going after new possibilities in the United States. And, you know, has been pointed out, well, certainly this would be the time that these major oil companies with these huge profits should either be looking into alternatives or into new, you know, new sites, new drilling.
You know, there's one comment about a lack of new refineries. One oil commentator said, listen, it's not really the environmental point. If there was a real demand commercially for new refineries, the oil majors, with all their political clout, they could overcome ecological problems and get these new refineries built. The reason they're really not pushing is they don't have enough new oil production to justify a lot of new refineries. Now, that was a very interesting comment to me, saying it's not because of environmental issues, it's because the oil is staying there to justify new refineries.
Just a couple more housekeeping matters. Please don't forget to sign up for our Larry Reed presentation, but I'd also like to take this opportunity to introduce Sydney Sweeting, one of our directors, Peter Young, one of our directors, Maria Camargo, who we're begging her, or she's helping us with some things here and there. She's, yes. And it's my pleasure to introduce our president, Joan Thompson, to say thank you.
Yes, thanks. Now, following on with Dick, I have a most wonderful presentation. I avoided giving this to him before he did his little talk, because you'll understand why when I tell you what the title of this book is. The title is called The Bottomless Well. It's called The Twilight of Fuel, The Virtue of Waste, and Why We Will Never Run Out of Energy. Now, of course, the whole issue here is energy. And Dick, you're just going to chew up, eat this book, and then we're going to have a discussion. A lot of energy. We're creating energy right here in this room. The more energy, this is what we do as human beings. We are energy creators. That is Julian Simon.
I mean, yes.
We have to discuss Julian Simon.
I mean, I think Julian Simon makes a very good point. There's endless energy in the world if you include the human imagination.
Exactly.
I just didn't agree with his point about oil specifically.
Well, we can stand that. But the point is that we are the unlimited resource. This applies to everything. Whatever. It is us. We are us. But the other interesting thing here is you raised a question about a possible conspiracy of negative things. This is also part of what we are. Also part of what we are is this sort of tendency to a Malthusian view of the world. We have that. Simon Lucy took the exactly opposite position. He refuted the Malthus theory or ideas, concept of limited resources, limited world, or increasing demand for which there could be no limited supply and no supply. And, of course, that can apply different to oil and to anything else. But I suggest this book is, I've mostly read it all, but I realize this is a perfect gift for Dick, and you can understand why I didn't give it to him in the beginning. It might have thrown him right off track. I hope it does.
The book I mentioned here, I haven't read it yet, but
yeah, we
haven't thought
of it.
But it throws it back to my thing. I will give it to you.
Right, you'll give it to me. I love it. Yes, right. All right. Okay. Thank you all for coming. I hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you.